Hello, my fellow tax cattle. I hope you're doing well. This is Zach, and you're listening to Reads on the Bitcoin Well podcast. Let me set the scene, because today's news is doing half of my job for me. As I record this, Bitcoin just slipped under 63,000. Not because of anything Bitcoin did. The whole risk market is having a bad week. There's an AI sell-off bleeding out of the stock market and into everything else. Fun one, a Chinese model called Kimi apparently just dethroned the big Western AIs in a coding benchmark, and somehow that tanked semiconductor stocks worldwide? Go figure. So if your portfolio's a little red, that's why. But let's try to shrink that amygdala and zoom out. There's a fresh US strike on Iran, with Trump's comments about China piling on the uncertainty. Another one. And the coverage will tell you everything about the missiles and nothing about the money. Because here's the question nobody on cable news wants to point out. How does an empire afford to do this over and over forever without ever once passing you the bill? Ever wonder why the wars never seem to run out of funding? Well, it's not an accident. That's the whole story today. Because underneath every modern war is a money story nobody talks about. Why can empires fight forever without asking you to pay? What actually backs the dollar now that gold's long gone? And why does that answer turn senseless wars into brutal, illogical ones? Today's piece pulls that thread all the way from Nixon closing the gold window, to the petrodollar handshake, to Venezuela, Libya, and yes, that strike on Iran you just heard about. Documented facts first, and then we'll put on our tinfoil hats while firmly resting in the cold, hard truth. Let's step out of the chaos of the news cycle and relax into some knowledge, understanding, and a bit of history. Questions, pushback, tinfoil theories of your own. Email me at z.adair@bitcoinwell.com. That's z.addair@bitcoinwell.com. In the meantime, enjoy the show. The war machine runs on fiat, or they knew the strait would close, and that was the point. In January 2026, the United States captured a sitting head of state, flew him to New York, and announced it would run his country. This time, nobody even bothered pretending it was about democracy. It was all about oil. And oil is about the dollar. Here's the money story running underneath every modern war, including the uncomfortable possibility that the disasters are actually successes, and that the rival superpowers quietly share a banker. Start with Venezuela. In January 2026, U.S. forces seized Nicolas Maduro, flew him to a courtroom in New York, and the administration said out loud that it would run the country through a transition. No weeping references to human rights this time. The stated prize was the oil, and within weeks there were multi-billion-dollar Venezuelan crude deals and open talks of keeping those barrels away from China. The mask didn't slip. They took it off consciously and set it on the table. That candor is the tell. So stay with me, because by the end of this, I'm going to make two claims that sound unhinged and then show you the hard facts that they're standing on. First, the Venezuela grab and the Iran war aren't two separate stories. They're two jaws of the same vice. And the disastrous closing of the Strait of Hormuz may be exactly the outcome the planners wanted in the first place, because they knew it was coming before the first bomb dropped. Second, the great power rivalry you're sold every night may, at the altitude where the real money moves, look less like a cage match and more like a staged one. I'll mark the exact line where documented facts stop and my speculation starts. But we can't get there until we answer a dumber question nobody bothers to ask. What actually backs the dollar? And what happens to a war when the honest answer is nothing? You see, hard money is annoying if you want to run an empire. Deeply annoying. Under a genuine gold standard, a government can only fight a war three ways. It can tax its citizens directly, which they notice and resent. It can borrow real savings, which runs out and drives up interest rates in a way voters feel. Or it can debase the coinage, which under a gold standard means physically clipping coins or diluting the metals, and markets catch that fast. All three have a hard ceiling. The war ends when the money runs out, and the money runs out fairly quickly because gold doesn't care about your foreign policy. This is not a fringe observation. This is the through line of the whole Austrian tradition. Murray Rothbard spent a career on the point that inflation is how the state buys what it can't openly charge you for, and there's nothing a state buys that is more expensive than war. Ludwig von Mises watched it happen in real time. He argued that the classical gold standard collapsed in 1914, not by accident, but by design, because World War I could not have been financed under it. Governments went off gold precisely so they could print. The order of operations matters. The money broke first, then the war got big, not the other way around. So the bloodiest century in human history opens with the abandonment of sound money and closes with Nixon finishing the job. Henry Hazlitt gave us the cleanest name for the mechanism. Inflation is a tax that nobody has to vote for. It's the one levy a government can impose without a single signature. A hidden transfer from everyone holding the currency to whoever spends the new money first. Now scale that mechanism up from a grocery bill to an aircraft carrier. A war financed by inflation is a war the public pays for without ever being asked. The bill arrives later, disguised as higher prices, and by then the bombs have already fallen. To put it simply, sound money makes you ask your citizens for their support, hat in hand. Fiat money lets you skip straight to the war. So what actually backs the dollar now? You've probably heard the meme, "What happened in 1971? Well, this is exactly what happened. In early August 1971, France sent a warship into New York Harbor with orders to haul home the gold it had parked at the New York Federal Reserve. Charles de Gaulle had spent years warning that the dollar's exorbitant privilege was a con, that America printed paper and shipped it abroad while everyone else did the real work. By 1971, the math was impossible to hide. The U.S. Treasury held roughly $10 billion in gold against more than $60 billion in foreign dollar claims. So on August 15th, Richard Nixon went on television and temporarily closed the gold window. Foreign governments could no longer swap dollars for metal. That temporary measure has now lasted more than half a century, and it never came back. Here's the part they skip in school. After 1971, the dollar had nothing behind it. No gold, no metal, no redemption. So why would anyone keep holding it, let alone use it as the world's reserve currency? Well, the answer got assembled in 1974, 3 years later. And it's one of the most consequential deals of the 20th century that most people have never heard of. Henry Kissinger, working the Saudi relationship, helped stitch together an arrangement. The Saudis would price their oil in dollars and only dollars, and then recycle those dollars straight back into U.S. Treasury securities. Oil, the single most important commodity on Earth, became the de facto collateral for the dollar. Every country that needed energy now needed dollars to buy it. Demand for the currency was manufactured out of thin air, backed by crude instead of gold. Now, there was never a single signed petrodollar deal. When headlines a couple of years ago screamed that the petrodollar agreement had expired, that was junk reporting. You can't expire a document that never formally existed as one binding pact. What existed was something sturdier and harder to kill, a wink, a handshake, and a mountain of convergent self-interests. Military protection flowing one way, oil price in dollars flowing the other. Once you understand that oil is the dollar's collateral, a whole category of senseless wars starts making brutal sense. If the dollar is backed by the world's willingness to buy oil in dollars, then any country that tries to sell its oil in something else is not making a trade decision. It's attacking the reserve currency, and empires don't treat attacks on their reserve currency as a difference of opinion. How the plumbing became a weapon. For a long time, the threat stayed mostly theoretical. Then the U.S. figured out it didn't need to seize your gold, it just needed to control the pipes your money moves through. In 2012, Iran was cut off from SWIFT, the messaging network that lets banks talk to each other across borders. SWIFT had always sold itself as a neutral utility, a boring Belgian cooperative with nothing to do with politics. That illusion died the day Iran got unplugged. The message to every other nation was unmistakable. The plumbing is not neutral, and Washington holds the wrench. Then came the big one in 2022, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The West froze roughly $300 billion of the Russian central bank's foreign reserve. Not a company's money, not an oligarch's yacht, a sovereign nation's central bank reserves, the rainy day fund of an entire country, frozen with the click of a mouse. Every central banker on the planet learned the same lesson that week. Dollar reserves are not property, they are permissions. You hold them at the pleasure of the issuer, and that permission can be revoked in an afternoon. If you were China or India or Saudi Arabia, and any nation that might one day find itself on the wrong side of Washington, what would you conclude? Exactly what they concluded: get out quietly before it's your turn. That's the real engine behind de-dollarization. Not ideology, self-preservation. China stood up its own payment rail, CIPS, SIPS, as a supposed SWIFT alternative. Although, here's a delicious irony that undercuts the whole rival bloc narrative. SIPS signed a memorandum of understanding with SWIFT, and to this day routes the large majority of its traffic over the very network it was built to replace. The alternative leans on the thing it claims to escape. File that away because it matters later. Now, let's speculate. Everything above is documented. Dates, dollar figures, signed or unsigned deals, all verifiable. From here, I'm going to connect the dots. Call it the informed guessing section, but notice that every guess is pinned to a hard fact. Start with Libya, 2011. The official story was humanitarian. NATO had to bomb the country to save it from Gaddafi. Here's the problem with that story. Before the bombs, Libya posted the highest standard of living in Africa. Free healthcare, free schooling, the top human development index on the continent, ranked around 53rd in the entire world. Then NATO liberated it. The state didn't wobble, it disintegrated, and it has spent more than a decade since as a failed state, split between rival governments and warring militias, the most worsened country of its decade on the Fragile States Index. And in 2017, CNN aired undercover footage of human beings, migrants, being auctioned at open-air slave markets outside Tripoli for a few hundred dollars a head. Slave markets. In the 21st century, if you set out to design the worst humanitarian outcome imaginable, you would struggle to beat a "we bomb the richest country in Africa" into open slave auctions. Which is the tell? The humanitarian story was never the mission. So look at what actually happened. Gaddafi had reportedly been floating a gold-backed pan-African currency, a gold dinar, meant to let African nations trade outside the dollar and the French-controlled franc. 143 tons of Libyan gold moved out of the central bank in Tripoli in early 2011, and one of the very first things the NATO-backed rebels did was seize the central bank and its reserves. Not the palace, the bank. And years later, French President Nicolas Sarkozy was convicted and, in October 2025, actually jailed over Gaddafi's alleged financing of his 2007 campaign. The loose ends of that war are still being tied off in a French prison cell. Which brings us back to Venezuela, the story I opened with. Remember, they told us themselves the price was oil. Here's the deductive leap. The point was arguably never to pump that crude for America at all. Venezuelan oil is heavy, nasty stuff that needs refining capacity that doesn't currently exist and would take years and a stable client government to build. The point was to deny it to a rival, to keep barrels off China's ledger and on the dollars. Now hold Venezuela in one hand and pick up Iran with the other. Because I don't think they're separate stories, I think they're two ends of the same move. The US struck Iranian nuclear sites in June 2025. Iran's parliament voted to close the Strait of Hormuz, And as of this month, there are fresh strikes and a naval blockade choking it, with tankers being boarded in international waters. Roughly a fifth of the world's oil moves through that channel, and the bulk of it is headed for Asia. Here's the detail that turns a blunder into a blueprint. American war planners have known for decades that shutting the strait is the very first thing Iran does the moment you hit it. It is the single most war-gamed contingency in the entire region. You do not stumble into the most predictable outcome on the board, not after planning for it since the 1980s. So if they went in knowing the strait would close, the uncomfortable conclusion is that a closed strait was the point, not a risk. And watch what the two moves do together. Venezuela chokes China's oil in the Western Hemisphere. The Hormuz chokes it in the Eastern. Both squeeze the one rival large enough to threaten the dollar. Both stampede energy-hungry buyers toward the net-exporting United States. And both keep the barrels priced in greenbacks. Everyone calls the Iran campaign a fiasco, but a fiasco that pulls off all three of those at once on a channel the planners knew would close before the first bomb dropped starts to look less like a fiasco and more like a spreadsheet balancing exactly as intended. Here's the biggest tinfoiliest thought of all. Remember SIPs quietly running on SWIFT? Remember the same officials cycling between the Western IMF and the BRICS alternative banks? What if the great power rivalry we're sold every night is, at the elite financial level, as planned as a WWE-style fake? Two sides that need each other to justify the budgets, their surveillance, and the wars, while capital sloshes freely between them behind the curtain. If you follow the money instead of the flags, it keeps refusing to stay inside the lines the map says it should. You don't have to buy all of this. Just notice that the vote never seems to change the outcome. People elected Obama to end the wars, and he expanded them and collected a Nobel for it. People elected Trump to stay out of the Middle East, and here we are. Left boot, right boot, same boot. Whoever the money serves, it isn't the guy at the ballot box. So what do you do with all this? Well, not despair, the opposite. Because once you see that the war machine runs on two fuels, the printing press and the captured payment rails, the exit becomes obvious. You starve both of them. The printing press only works because the money is infinite. Bitcoin is the first money in history with a supply schedule no president, central banker, or wartime emergency can override. You can't inflate it to quietly fund a war the public would never approve. The leash that gold put on empires, the one Nixon cut in 1971, Bitcoin ties back on. And this time it's made of math instead of metal, and there's no window to close. The captured rails only work because your money lives inside someone else's system. They froze $300 billion of a central bank's reserve because those reserves sat in accounts they controlled. You can't freeze what you hold in self-custody. There is no SWIFT to delist you from, no annex to seize, no permission to revoke. Bitcoin held with your own keys is the first reserve asset that is genuinely neutral. It doesn't care whether you're in the axis of resistance or the free world. It doesn't take sides because it can't. Code doesn't do foreign policy. That neutrality is the whole point. This isn't Mises or Rothbard or Rand being quoted for flavor. It's their argument arriving at its logical endpoint. Mises said money had to be taken out of the hands of the state, where the state would abuse it without limit. And he was right. And for 100 years, there was no way to actually do it. But now there is. Every generation gets sold the same story. This war is different. This enemy is uniquely dangerous. This time, the printing is justified. And every generation pays for it twice. Once in blood and once in the slow theft of a debased currency. The costume changes, but the invoice doesn't. You can't personally stop the next intervention. But you can decide whether your savings are conscripted into funding it. Every dollar sitting in the system is a small loan to the machine, redeployable at will, inflatable on command. Every sat held in your own custody is a dollar the machine can't reach. Not your keys, not your coins. And when the money itself is the weapon, not your keys means not your war. That's the quiet power of opting out, and it's exactly what Bitcoin Well was built to make simple. Buy, sell, and hold Bitcoin in genuine self-custody so your savings answer to you and no one else. Thanks for listening.